and welcome to It's Complicated, a podcast about healthcare ethics in practice, presented by the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network, or NCHEN. I'm Andrea Frolick, Interim Network Ethicist for NCHEN, and I'll be your host for this discussion. I am super excited to welcome two special guests who are joining me today from Hamilton, Ontario. Kirsten Kroll calls herself a liberated student, having transitioned from a lifelong career in hospital services in Ontario with more than 20 years as a chief nursing executive and executive leader of clinical operations and organizational services, supporting quality, safety, patient experience, and advancements in clinical education, professional practice, and ethics, to name a few. Welcome, Kirsten.
It's a pleasure to be here with my colleagues and with our audience today.
And Diana Tickus is a registered social worker with 3 decades of experience working as a trauma-trained therapist. Although very passionate about her work, and I know that firsthand, she also recognized at times being negatively impacted by the stories she was hearing, the systemic injustices she witnessed, and the ongoing pressures of working in a fast-paced, complex environment. Exploring how to sustain her own career brought her to work in association with Tend Academy, who assist various helping organizations across North America in how best to support their staff to stay well while doing trauma-exposed work.
Thanks for having me here today. I'm really excited to do this with both of you.
Kirsten, Diana, and I collaborated on a recent paper published in the Healthcare Management Forum Journal entitled An Ecological Approach to Humanizing Healthcare Organizations for Patients, Healthcare Providers, and Communities. And I'm really excited to talk today about some of the key ideas that we worked on developing and communicating in that paper. So how did we come together to write this paper? Well, we'd worked together for about a decade at Hamilton Health Sciences in different roles. So Kirsten was the CNE and VP for Quality and Performance. I was the director of ethics, and Diana was a social worker and ethics committee member. And we had the chance to collaborate in different ways to address occupational stress, starting with offering mindfulness-based interventions and self-compassion courses to staff, leaders, and physicians, starting back in 2012. And we were really united by a vision to bring humanity back into healthcare, and our paper attempts to summarize almost a decade's worth of experimenting, refining, learning, and collaborating together. So Kirsten, I'm hoping you can start us off by describing what signs, symptoms, or indicators that you were seeing in the health system that we had a problem with occupational stress in our organization.
Great. Thank you, Andrea. I don't think any of these symptoms are a surprise to people at large, but certainly we were seeing lots of comments and stresses in people regarding being overworked, comments about being emotionally exhausted. You could see people, even just observe them in meetings, the reactions that they were having with us, certainly more tears and so on in the organization. Our team, including Andrea and Diana and others, were being called upon by teams to assist with conflicts and distress from crisis events, for sure, but other, cumulative issues that were going on. And again, in healthcare at large, also at Hamilton Health Sciences, was the increasing turnover rate of people and also their absences from work. On top of all this, of course, the organization was trying to introduce a number of major organization changes to really try and better the culture, but also to really give people the tools and practices that they needed for their future. Within the organization, of course, that brings on a lot more stress to people as they really try and keep up with all these changes that feel like they're piling on, which in fact they probably were. Anyways, so in trying to create an engagement culture in all of this, what we were doing was actually creating more stress in the organization, and we needed to find a way to deal with that. So I'll turn it back to Andrea to really help us identify, what is the problem we're really trying to solve here?
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you were seeing, as a leader, individual challenges, team challenges, and also challenges in trying to move change and organizational improvement initiatives forward. And one of the things that Diana and I started to explore through the funding through an AMS Phoenix Fellowship was, what does the evidence actually say about what the causes of occupational stress are and what are effective evidence-based mitigation strategies? And we realized that there was a serious problem because a lot of the programming and messaging in our institution around stress in the workplace really focused on, well, this is an individual problem and an individual responsibility, when the evidence was pointing to the fact that it's an organizational, structural, and cultural problem. So we felt this ethical dilemma around the fact that our organization was in some ways misdiagnosing or misattributing the causes of occupational stress as a kind of individual weakness and making individuals responsible for their own well-being in the workplace. So I wonder, Diana, if you can talk a little bit about what you found in the literature and what you see as the most important roots of this problem of occupational stress.
Great. Thank you, Andrea. I think really what was happening is our organization, as many organizations, were certainly well-intentioned in wanting to support staff. However, they were missing the mark because they were failing to consider numerous other complexities. So I'm going to kind of go through some of those right now to really broaden the lens with how we are looking at this issue. So I think first of all, and I know I may be stating the obvious, but human beings are very complex and the environments we work in are very complex. And I think, you know, our well-meaning approaches to supporting staff often go awry because we are oversimplifying by focusing solely on building individual staff resilience. And so what that happens when we do that is we send out the message essentially, oh, you just got to shore yourselves up, staff member. And when we do that, we're not focusing on the environment in which the person finds themselves in. And so we end up ignoring that. And then I think people can get quite resistant and resentful because it feels like they're being asked to compensate for environments that actually aren't creating ideal working conditions. I also think that that inherently in healthcare, we have a culture that I think still implicitly and explicitly conveys that our conditions, the conditions we work in, are just part of the job. And as a result, we just need to suck it up and get on with it. And I think, quite frankly, many of the healthcare professionals have even been trained in this kind of culture. And so what we learn is that emotions are just not part of the job. And so when we believe this, there are no attempts made to change the culture, to allow human beings to be human beings. And inherently being a human being means that you have emotions. And so then, you know, Kirsten very aptly described a lot of the things that we were starting to see as outcomes as a result of, squashing our humanness and ignoring the environment. So I think another thing, furthermore, what I'm going to say is that we are not talking about in healthcare how we work in trauma-exposed environments. And what that simply means is that on a regular daily basis, we are exposed directly and indirectly to human suffering and loss. And again, as human beings, we can't help but be touched by that. And I think, unfortunately, many of our workplaces are labeling what we're struggling with as burnout. And I think that's a disservice, I'll put it that way, because burnout essentially describes having more work in front of us than we can handle. And of course, that's our reality in healthcare. But unfortunately, it it doesn't highlight other realities that we also face, which are lack of resources, continual systemic constraints that that can lead us to experiencing moral distress. And it also does not consider the extent to which we are bumping up against that human suffering day in and day out, and ourselves are also suffering at times. So as a result, no space is made in our work environments to be able to openly discuss this, to validate it, to normalize it, and to work through these things collectively, and to create conditions in the environment that support this. Now, the last thing I'll say before I turn it back to both of you is I think as well we fail to consider the neurophysiology of all of us as human beings. And what we need to remember is that we have nervous systems that are inherently designed to react to stressors in the environment. So increased threats in the environment and or chronic stressful conditions result in various levels of survival response or fight, flight, freeze response for all individuals working within those conditions. And so, quite frankly, the more activated our survival response is, or we can look at it as our downstairs brain or survival brain, we are not necessarily being our best selves. We have less access to our problem-solving brain, to our ability to make moral and ethical decisions, even our ability to be compassionate with ourselves and others. And so I think, too, over time, what we start to see is people turning on each other rather than towards each other. We can become more reactive. I think, again, Kirsten described that really, really well at the beginning. We can actually get entrenched in this us versus them mentality, where we're starting to point fingers to, often frontline points fingers at leadership, leadership points fingers at the frontline. We're pointing fingers across units, across departments. They just don't understand us. It's somebody else's job to make this better. And so, you know, we're marinating in these kind of environments and behaviors. And so I really think that understanding ourselves in the context of neurophysiology and how it's in constant interaction with our complex health environment helps us to not blame and shame individuals, because it's how we're wired up. And you know, labeling behaviors, I think, as uncivil and so on, lacks this understanding of the larger dynamic, and lacks the understanding of how we are continuously interacting in these high stress, complex environments.
Thank you, Diana. I really appreciate you laying out for us the complexity of the roots of occupational stress. It sounds to me like the roots of this issue related to occupational stress are biological and individual and interpersonal and structural and organizational.
Right. Which brings us to our whole ecological approach.
Correct? Right on. Yeah. So Kirsten and Diana and I muddled over this challenge that we encountered when we looked at the evidence and looked at what was going on within our organization. And we had, by around 2016, 2017, trained hundreds of healthcare providers and leaders in mindfulness and self-compassion practices. But we recognized that there were many cultural and social barriers to helping people integrate some of these evidence-based approaches to help them regulate their nervous system and enhance their relationships with each other. And that we needed a model that really helped to capture the complexity of the problem that Diana has described. And so we struck on this idea of a care ecology. An ecological model of care recognizes that all acts of care in a healthcare organization are carried out within a dynamic system of relationships that span across communities, spaces, and structures. each layer of relationship influences all others in both subtle and direct ways. So we used the sort of science of ecology or ecological systems and then applied that model to how we see care being delivered. And as Diana has articulated, there are many factors that impact a care ecology, the well-being of staff and funding, community support, decision-making procedures. And so the goal in developing a care ecology is to create a sustainable and healthy system so individuals feel supported by the whole system in providing excellent care. And in the paper, we give some specific examples around how we experimented with bringing the model of a care ecology to life in our health system. So, Kirsten, I wonder if we can turn to you now and talk a little bit about how you experimented as a health leader with bringing a care ecology model into practice and what you see as some of the implications for leaders and leadership of a care ecology approach to occupational stress.
Great. Thank you, Andrea. And I think it's a really nice segue because the organization was implementing what we called a continuous quality improvement model based on the shingle model of operational excellence or something like the Toyota production system that might ring some bells for people who are listening today. One of the premises there is very much focused on systems, right? It is a model that really tries to bring perspective to how people think about their environments and looking at that whole interaction of those different layers of the organization for problem solving. The intent was to create 13,000 problem solvers who would really work together and bring excellence to the organization and innovation. One of the fundamental basis of this model is that leaders are humble and they bring respect to the organization, which, you know, sounds like a great idea. And we expect people to just kind of weigh into this and figure it out. Unfortunately, you know, we had a lot of tools like a huddle sheet where the manager is interacting with a staff member or a team leader to work through, you know, observations, what's happening in the environment, what are the feelings of people. They would have huddles with the teams on a daily basis. They would go into the workplace and use more observation skills. But as an organization, what were we doing to really try and amp up people's abilities to look at their world differently, open those perspectives, see, hear, feel their environments in a different way that really could make a difference, and understand that emotional labor that is going on around that trauma and so on? How do we make leaders get in touch with that in the busyness of their day of really just even trying to staff a unit? How do we bring the leader as a person into this humanizing model that we're trying to create? So we did create an advanced reflection call with a peer group. And this was, you know, leaders from different levels of the organization, I'll say from a manager, director, even VPs got involved in these weekly phone calls. And it was a phone call. In some cases, we did face-to-face. But these advanced reflection calls were really intended to try and bring that safe space for leaders who are also, you know, hijacked with emotions and facing their own trauma. How do we create a safe space for them to actually take time out, reflect, use some of the techniques that we're being trained in mindfulness and so on to bring these new skills to reality? This is not natural for people. They have to develop it over time, and you cannot expect people to do that on their own. They can to a certain point, but a peer group who share stories that people understand they are not alone with their own emotions and what they're experiencing day in and day out, that is very tough work that they're doing, that peer group is helping to shape those skills and abilities of leaders. It reduces their isolation, and it really is a nice model of how do you make people connect in a different way, one that is emotional and brings some of that tough conversation, but is also creating a safety net so people feel confident in their abilities to create that safe space. If we can do that with leaders together as a peer group, the chances of them actually being able to do that with their teams is amplified. They need to build that ability. Now, how do they take it out with their teams? And they've got some great role models and by being part of that peer group. So it is time that is needed for people to do this from the point of view of ongoing development. But the actual connection time was actually not all that intensive. You know, every week, half an hour, 45 minutes for groups to get together to have that conversation. And people would get restored. They would get refueled at the end of those meetings to start the day and understand, how can I bring more positivity to work? So it's a really nice example of trying to tie this in to a massive organization change that really is trying to create a bigger system perspective.
So Kirsten, I'm going to jump in here because I was part of those groups as well. And I can attest to that they didn't take a very long time. And the shift I would see within that half hour from how leaders came in to how they exited, they felt far more grounded, far more supported, far more ready for the day. And when you're talking about the quality of humility and wanting to have 13,000 problem solvers, we need to be grounded in a calm nervous system, or relatively calm nervous system, to be able to do this. And we distilled it down to a simple framework that we refer to as pause, reset, and nourish. So you'll notice that the initials are PRN. And so those weren't accidental, because of course we know that PRN is annotated as needed, right? So we engage in PRN as needed. And so what we did is very much took the science, and were influenced by what neurophysiology was telling us about individual nervous systems, but also how nervous systems are continuously talking with each other. We can catch others' emotions. We can, and as a result, we can also co-regulate. And so this is where groups are helpful in helping people find ways to quickly ground themselves. And so PRN can be done individually, but ideally as a team. And considering the ecology, what we were doing with PRN is we wanted to embed it into the flow of the work. So it was to be embedded into the unit context, not as something extra to do, but as something that we sprinkle throughout the work shift. And so essentially what that framework looks like is that we will pause. So we encourage people to take a moment to do a U-turn and check in with themselves, check in with their nervous systems. Am I hyper aroused? Am I hypo aroused? How do I get myself more grounded? How do I help my colleague get more grounded? Which brings to the reset. So the R is the reset. So there are numerous quick micro practices that we encourage folks to engage in that take 30 seconds, 90 seconds, not a long time, to help them reset. And then nourish is taking another moment to drink in the benefits of that practice. And so in this way, we were embedding this strategy to help each other, I guess, you know, stay grounded and be our best selves.
Thank you so much, Diana. I felt myself resetting as you were describing the practice. And we could talk all day. This is such a complex, deep, and dynamic area of research and practice. But I'm going to do our final speed round for both of you now. So implementing a care ecology model sounds complicated, but what is one tool or resource or strategy you would recommend to begin to integrate a care ecology model to address trauma exposure and occupational stress with the teams that people support? So Kirsten, you can start.
Yeah, I think leaders really need to just absorb this sort of information and reflect, like get out and actually think about your world a little differently. What are you observing? What are you hearing? But I will emphasize, as somebody who was an executive in an organization, it is an organization responsibility to take this on. It is strategic. It matters to the emotional labor that is going on day in and day out in organizations. And I would challenge people to actually think about how some of these measures of this psychological status of people is actually reflected in your quality and safety scorecards, because there is a direct connection. When these things start to slide and start to become more amplified, you will see implications to quality and safety of care. So think about, how does this show up in your conversations about the actual care being provided in the organization?
So I'll jump in again quickly, because it does make my heart sing, Kirsten, to hear you say that it is an organizational responsibility. And I think the little resource I'm going to suggest is one of my all-time favorite books called Compassionomics, because this whole book is curating 180 research article, well-structured research that was done on the benefits of compassion, not only to the receiver of compassion, but to the giver of compassion, and also to anyone who's witnessing a compassionate act. So this book was written by Stephen Treziak and Anthony Mazzarelli. They are both physicians. Stephen Treziak is a researcher as well. And the book began as an investigation about how to address what they were calling the compassion crisis in healthcare. I think that's another way to look at humanizing healthcare. And Stephen Treziak himself says that he was highly skeptical when he started to undertake this, because he was also trained in the suck it up buttercup kind of culture. And so he didn't think compassion would be helpful. The evidence shows the contrary. And so he was quite amazed how leaning into our work, how becoming very very skilled at delivering, and also I'm going to say receiving compassion, because we're not also very good at receiving help, I think, in healthcare, how that really made a difference for him. Because as he was going through the research, he also realized that he was very much struggling with he termed it burnout, but struggling with the impacts of doing this work. And so he did a little experiment of one, and started to lean into his work and with intentionally being compassionate, and it turned things around for him.
Thanks, Diana, for that resource, and thanks to Kirsten for your inspiration and challenge around how leaders, executives, and whole organizations can begin to think about how to integrate the model of a care ecology across their organization. So thank you, both of you, for sharing your lived experiences, your expertise, and your reflections today on humanizing healthcare. And we so appreciate your time and your insight. And we continue to be grateful for our production support from Lisbeth Nielsen, Krista Malesko-Scarry, and the team at Dalhousie MedIT. And thanks to Ben Capps for our theme music. And most of all, thanks to all of you for listening. We'll see you next time.